Well, thank you very much, Lathan. Thank you for the opportunity to speak and to visit Canada virtually. Again, my home country. It's a pleasure to do that. And I will talk today about this new debate that's arisen over the value of the Hubble constant. And I recognize that not everybody in the audience is familiar with the details of how we measure distances. And so I don't want to overload you with a lot of detail, but I hope you will give me some latitude to describe why it is that we are having the discussions that we're having today and why this problem is not resolved. And so at its heart, what we're trying to do locally is measure the distances to nearby galaxies. That's the basis of what Edwin Hubble did almost a century ago, where he was able to establish the distances to nearby galaxies, establish that there was this proportionality between the distance of a galaxy and its velocity, and measure the current or the local expansion rate of the universe. And of course, Hubble measured a value of over 500, and many of those reasons he could not have overcome, they had to do with the detectors at the time that were photographic plates, had non-linearities in terms of measuring accurate luminosities that wasn't feasible for Hubble and others who followed. And then there were real astrophysical effects. For example, the presence of dust that's formed in the atmospheres of stars and is along the line of sight from us to the objects we're trying to measure the luminosities of. And so it wasn't really until the availability of the Hubble Space Telescope in the early 1990s, repaired in end of 1993, that we were able to get above the Earth's atmosphere, measure the luminosities of the Cepheid stars that, in fact, Edwin Hubble had used. It was the main method he used for measuring the distances to galaxies, and do this free of the turbulence in the Earth's atmosphere, which causes blurring of the objects that we're trying to measure against the background surface brightness level in the galaxy. So Hubble really has been our tool in the last couple of decades, quarter of a century now, for measuring accurate distances to galaxies. Now, as Lathan alluded to, we were looking in the 1980s at a debate over the rate of expansion at a level of a factor of two. So the arguments were between values of 50 or 100 kilometers per second per megaparsec. With Hubble, we were able to beat down the systematic errors, amongst them non-linearities in the earlier photometry, corrections for reddening, corrections for the abundances of the Cepheids that affects their luminosities, and a larger sample of galaxies that we could use to do the calibration. Things have improved enormously over the last couple of decades since we published our results from the Key Project. The value of the Hubble constant that you get using Cepheids has remained in the low to mid 70s. That hasn't changed, although the uncertainties have become smaller. And now what we're up against is when we compare the value of the Hubble constant calibrated using Cepheids with the value of the Hubble constant that is inferred using the Planck satellite, for example, measurements of the cosmic microwave background. More recent ground-based experiments, the ACT Atacama Cosmology Telescope, the South Pole Telescope, those measurements are giving a smaller value of the Hubble constant. And just simplistically, at high redshift, the value of the Hubble constant that's being estimated, and I'll describe how that's done in a moment, is about 74 kilometers per second per megaparsec. And the Cepheid calibration is giving more like 73 or 74. So given where we were between 50 and 100, there's actually now we are agreeing at better than the 10% level. That is real progress. However, the uncertainties, the error bars that are being quoted are small enough that this appears to be a significant difference. Depending on what uncertainties you allow for each of these measurements, particularly for the local measurements, as I'll describe in a moment, this could be anywhere in the 4 to 6 sigma tension level, which is the level of a crisis, as some people have called it. So the question really is now, is this a measurement that has now the systematics are under control and that we can infer something about the early universe? Because obviously, so the Planck measurements give you an opportunity to estimate what the current expansion rate would be locally. And the current standard cosmological model, the so-called Lambda CDM model, which has a component 30% dark matter, 70% dark energy, is giving, if you assume that model then and extrapolate to the current day, you would get a value of 67. So something may be different. We may be learning something really fundamental about the universe. And this is how we would do that, is to make accurate measurements locally to test the standard model. So it's why this is an exciting topic at the moment, and why so many of us are trying to unravel and ascertain, do we really need a change to the standard model, some additional change. Now, this is a plot of the Hubble constant, historical values of the Hubble constant, the beginning with early Edwin Hubble's measurements, where he measured a value of close to 500 kilometers per megaparsec. That was revised by about a factor of 2 in the 1950s. And then the measurements tended to end up in this range of 50 to 100 for a few decades. And with the Key Project, we were able to measure a value of 72 with an uncertainty of 10%. Now I'm showing the measurements since the time of the Key Project. Here's our value for the Key Project that we published in 2001. And these are measurements of the Hubble constant calibrated by these Cepheid variables up until the present day. So much of the recent work has been done by Adam Riess and his SHOES team. This measurement here, the Carnegie Hubble Project, is a project we carried out using the Spitzer Mid-Infrared Space Telescope. As I'll describe, this allows you to overcome many of the systematics that plague the Cepheids. And you can see the value really has remained rather constant, surprisingly constant perhaps, but the uncertainties have continued to decrease with time. Now, if we look at the measurements from the microwave background, this is beginning with the Wilkinson microwave anisotropy probe shortly after the Key Project, those values have tended to come down with time, and so have the uncertainties, and they've settled in this 67 or so range. These are values that are published by the ACT group in combination with the WMAP observations, but they're in very good agreement at the 67 kilometer per second per megaparsec level. I'm not going to talk very much today about these gravitational wave sirens as measurements of two inspiraling neutron stars measured by LIGO and then followed up in the electromagnetic spectrum so that you can get a redshift. I think this is a very promising method for the future. Unfortunately, there's only one object to date, and we hope in future there'll be many more such objects, and this can shed some light on the current tension. The advantage is that the physics course is completely independent. I will make that point several times today. I think we need several independent distance estimates. Then we can ascertain what the overall systematic uncertainty in the measurement is. That was the philosophy of the Key Project. I'll show you in a moment. We had many independent methods, and I think it has stood the test of time. We aren't there at the current time, I would say, with measurements today at the 1% level that people are aspiring to reach. And that's to understand if this difference that is being measured is significant. As I mentioned, this is being quoted as a 4 in the meeting I've been attending early in the morning this week in Tehran. It's a meeting on the Hubble tension. Values of 6 sigma are being quoted. So the discrepancy is real. If the systematics have been accounted for, this is a crisis. This would demand new physics. Now, our group has been from the ground up. So spent a lot of time working on Cepheids, continuing to work on Cepheids and try and understand whether we have accurate measurements now that could actually support this extraordinary claim. You need extraordinary evidence. And with a single method, you won't, of course, understand whether your own systematics of a given method have been overcome. The way you do that is by independent methods. So that was the motivation for our group to begin a ground up calibration of the distance scale using a class of stars known as red giant branch stars. These are stars that are solar mass and less. They're older evolved stars. They've climbed up the giant branch, and we can measure their luminosities very accurately. And I'll say more about that in a moment. So we ended up, this is a public paper that we published summer before last, in between the two values. So we agree well with the cosmic microwave background. At face value, there'd be no need for new physics, but we also agree with the Cepheids at a two sigma level. So clearly we have not resolved this tension at the moment. Now, let me just step back and say a few words about the microwave background measurements, and probably most of you are familiar with these, but essentially the satellites like WMAP and Planck can measure now very accurately temperature fluctuations over the sky. You can expand those measurements into spherical harmonics, and the CLs here are the coefficients of the spherical harmonics, and this is just the logarithmic version here in microkelvin squared. So this is a scale size decreasing to the right. These are large scales seen on the left here. And the 1 degree scale here, this first acoustic peak, represents the angular size of the sound horizon. And the line here, which you can't really see except at the ends of the spectra, of the spectrum shown here, that is a fit to the lambda cool dark matter model. That is a model in which you have 30% matter, most of which is dark matter, and 70% approximately a cosmological constant. Here are the most recent data from the Planck 2018 measurements. And what they have done here is the blue line here is a 6-parameter only fit to the data. You can see it's an exquisite fit. So these are the temperature fluctuations shown on the top. And now it's also possible to make polarization measurements. So this is the TE spectrum. And again, it's a phenomenal fit to a lambda CDM model. And it doesn't require any other parameters. Now, these are measurements from the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, so put together with Planck and ACT and SPT, the South Pole Telescope, polarization measurements and other experiments. And so there's the TT, here's EE, and here's the TE cross-correlation spectrum. Again, a phenomenal fit. So the people in these groups have tested for systematics in their own experiments. The fact now that ACT and Planck agree so well suggests that this is not an experimental problem with, say, the Planck results. Agrees also well with WMAP. And they have investigated their systematics in terms of the experiment quite accurately. So that doesn't seem to be a source of a problem right now. And the independence of the ACT, which are ground-based measurements, also SPT, to within the uncertainties that have been measured to date with Planck suggests that there's very good agreement. And they are giving for the Hubble constant values of 67.4, or in the case of ACT WMAP, 67.6. So I've listed the measurements now that are also based on polarization. And I should say that with polarization now, you can measure the cosmological parameters independently from the temperature measurements, and the results for cosmology are really very consistent. Now, the Cepheids, I've said, are coming in at 74 or 73, including our own work in 2012 based on Spitzer and that of the recent Adam Riese team. And the tip of the red giant branch, we're getting just under 70. And with a less than 3% uncertainty, the uncertainty that's been quoted now for the Cepheids is at the 1.8% level. I'll just mention briefly, there's a technique using strong gravitational lensing that was giving a very high value. This gave a lot of people pause when they were maybe a bit skeptical about the high values, but it was coming in high based on 6 gravitational lenses. But there's been a reanalysis by a subset of the same group that relaxed the assumption of what the mass distribution and the underlying lenses are. That was an assumption. And when you do that, that increases the uncertainty. And then they obtained more kinematic data to put more empirical constraints on the mass distributions in the lenses. And then the value of the Hubble constant comes down to 67.4. So at the moment, that's changed the side of the ledger. And people have been listening to this meeting in Tehran all this week. People are arguing about whether or not all of the evidence is on one side or another. I think it's on both sides at the moment. Now, this is the probability density distribution for the CMB measurements, and these are our measurements of the tip of the Red Giant branch. And as I said, they're perfectly consistent. We would say this is a 1.1 sigma tension, not a tension at all, in other words. So I'm going to completely put aside the possibility that there are systematic errors for the moment and say we have all of our systematics under control. What we're seeing at high redshift is a low value of the Hubble constant, and it requires some physical explanation as to why the value that we're measuring locally is different. And this, of course, would be extremely interesting. It would be pointing to some new fundamental physics that we don't yet have in our standard cosmological model. So there have been now hundreds, literally, of papers that have been written on this subject. People have been looking into this in a lot of detail. It's a very interesting question. What could be explaining this difference if it is real? What's very interesting is that as the Planck data have become more and more accurate with the release of additional data up to 2018, the measurements of those peaks that I showed you are so well determined now that many of the possibilities that were considered early on, for example, an additional neutrino or some other relativistic species, what people are referring to as dark radiation, those would have an effect on the position of those peaks, position and heights of those peaks. And so it becomes very hard to adjust to allow for a difference in the Hubble constant. And it turns out that because of the types of degeneracies, you move things one way, they move elsewhere. But the constraints now from the CMB data alone, especially coming now from polarization, make it very difficult to add additional parameters without really torquing the solution elsewhere. So this doesn't appear now to be a good way of resolving the difference. People have considered now we don't know what the dark energy is, let alone its equation of state. The equation of state for dark energy for Einstein's cosmological constant, so the ratio of the pressure to energy density, this factor W, is -1 for a cosmological constant. Perhaps it evolves with redshift, and people have looked into that. It seemed like a very reasonable possibility. But measurements now from matter fluctuations, the baryon acoustic oscillations, are constrained that Hubble parameter is a function of redshift really quite well now. So you need a very contrived, non-physically motivated change in the Hubble constant as a function, Hubble parameter as a function of redshift. That doesn't appear to be very viable at the moment. And so on, dark matter, decaying particles, modified gravity, non-zero spatial curvature, a lot of recent attention to the very early universe, so prior to recombination, and suggestions perhaps you have some sort of scalar field that changes the expansion rate, but then decays right at recombination so that you don't see its effects on the late time peaks. So I think the reason people are skeptical, rightly so, is that you need to posit this additional field for which there's no motivation physically, and then turn it off right at the point where you could observe it later. And so in essence, two tooth fairies are required. And so I think the statement at the current time, and certainly in this meeting in Tehran this week, there is no model that has emerged that can explain the Hubble constant tension. There are other, for example, sigma 8 fluctuations on 8 megaparsec scales. There seems to be a slight tension with the microwave background data, but nothing at the level of 6 sigma that is being claimed for the Hubble constant. So no explanation yet. Of course, that doesn't say anything about whether or not the universe actually has a different Hubble constant at early redshift. We just don't have an explanation for it yet, if it is indeed real. So where are we now? And I'm showing you these a more recent compilation of published Hubble constants, including all methods that have been published. And you can see that in the 1980s here on the left, the scatter was still quite large. So with time, that scatter has come down. I'm just showing in histogram form here. So the yellow points are all points. And by the time we get to this past decade, 2010 to 2020, the dispersion in the measurements has decreased. The median mode and average, any way you want to look at this, is giving about 68 or 69. So here in black are the CMB measurements. It's not just the CMB measurements, as sometimes said, that are giving the lower values. Different methods are also giving some low values. Now, I don't want to belabor this point, but it is really critical for this topic, and that is we need both precision. There's no question that for individual distance methods, now we are getting much higher precision, and that has been really improving in the last couple of decades. So has the accuracy, as we've been able for nearby galaxies to compare on a galaxy by galaxy basis with completely independent calibrations, how well those methods agree. But overall, again, accuracy is the important issue here. And this is hard for astrophysical objects, or we would have solved it by now. I just want to make clear the steps that we take in terms of setting the absolute scale on the left here. When we measure distances to galaxies and we are observing Cepheid variables or tip of the red giant branch stars, we need to know their absolute luminosities, their wattage, their actual luminosities. And we can measure their relative distances really quite accurately now, but it's setting the calibration that is, again, key, because that sets the scale size of the universe. What we are using now are, fortunately, we have a number of different techniques now that are based on geometry, not only parallaxes of individual stars like the Cepheids or red giants, but also, for example, their water megamasers. These are objects, for example, I'll show in a moment, the nearby galaxy NGC 4258 harbors a black hole in its center, and very accurate observations of the water megamasers that are rotating about the center of the black hole allow you, radial velocities also allow you to determine the distance of this nearby galaxy via geometry. So we set the calibration via geometry, and now there's more than one way to do that, a test of systematics. Then we move out to the realm where we need to make measurements with the Hubble Space Telescope of the Cepheids in the disks of these galaxies, or the red giant branch stars in the halos of the galaxies. That's the 7 to 30 megaparsec, millions of parsec range. And then we tie into galaxies where type 1a supernovae, these explosions, presumably companion stars that are dumping stars onto material onto evolved stars, white dwarfs that then explode and are much brighter than the Cepheids or the red giant branch stars, so that we can measure out into the actual Hubble flow, where galaxies are participating in the Hubble flow and their interaction, gravitational interactions with their nearby neighbors, and not causing perturbations to the Hubble velocities. We can get out past that. Ideally, what you would like is to be able to calibrate supernovae directly without this intermediate step. Type 1a supernovae are extremely rare. They happen about once a century per galaxy. And so what is accessible to us from Hubble using Cepheids or red giant branch stars, these occur about one every 1.5 years or so. So the sample for which we can measure then Cepheids or tip of the red giant branch calibrated geometrically that also have type 1a supernovae at the moment is less than 20. It's 18 for the tip of the red giant branch and 19 for Cepheids. And so while we can measure the relative distances to supernovae, samples of 100 or now up to 1,000, they still need to be tied into the galaxies that have also had type 1a supernovae and also have Cepheid calibrated or TRGB distances. So here are the two independent paths to H-naught that have been developed. They're in the most mature state now. You will hear about other distance indicators, things called Myra variables, things called surface brightness fluctuations. It's a tertiary distance indicator. The gravitational lensing, six objects, I mentioned those, understanding the mass distributions. So there, I'd say consistency checks for some of these other methods, but we don't have the opportunity to actually measure the same using in the same galaxy using different techniques and check again for systematics on a galaxy by galaxy basis, the way we do for these two methods. And the samples still are small for these two methods, but they are independent in the sense that the physics of the tip of red giant branch stars is completely different than that of physics. Our groups, this is our Carnegie supernova project carried out in the decade before I left Carnegie to measure type 1a supernovae. And then there are other surveys that the other group has used. And then we have a number of different calibrators, but different for each of the methods. So let me say some words about the Cepheid distance scale. Cepheids still remain a gold standard for measuring distances, and for very good reason. The Cepheids themselves show a well-determined relationship between their luminosity. This is luminosity increasing up, and the log of the period of variation. These stars' atmospheres are in motion. This was a relationship discovered by Henrietta Leavitt just over a century ago. And what we've learned in recent years is that the scatter in this period luminosity relation, what we now call the Leavitt law, decreases as you go to longer wavelengths. That's simply a consequence of the fact that the temperature sensitivity decreases as you go to luminosity decreases as you go to longer wavelengths. So at the K band, which is 2.2 microns, the dispersion in the period luminosity relation is only about a tenth of a magnitude, or 5% in distance. So that means if you have a sample of 100 Cepheids, then in principle you have better than a 1% different distance. But of course, the name of the game again is beating down the systematic errors. The nice thing about Cepheids is that as you go to longer and longer wavelengths, the dispersion in the period luminosity relation decreases, so you can measure more accurate distances. Also, there's an advantage going to infrared wavelengths, because one of the issues we have to contend with is these are young stars. Therefore, we find them in the disks of spiral galaxies. They're young, so they haven't dispersed very far from the regions where they were born. So there's gas and there's dust, and we need to correct for that. The longer wavelength we can make the observations, the less the effects of dust. Now, and also it turns out the smaller the effects of abundance, the chemical composition on the luminosity of the stars. So a lot of advantages. They're bright. They're amongst the first stars that we see when we resolve individual stars in these nearby galaxies. We used those for the key project with Hubble. These are early results. We used five different methods for measuring the relative distances to galaxies. And you can, so this is velocity as a function of distance. This is just exactly what Edwin Hubble plotted when he first discovered the relation. And this, the green points here that extend out the farthest, and this is just a projection now taking out the expansion, which we measured at 72, they extend the farthest because supernovae are the brightest, and they have this very small dispersion in their luminosities. And so most of the work that has been done in the last couple of decades has concentrated on the type 1a supernovae. And this is, again, showing the relative probability density distributions for the different methods that we used. And each of them here is shown, represented by a Gaussian, the dispersion of which is the statistical error for each method. And the bars are showing the systematic uncertainties for each. And this is the cumulative distribution. Whether we use Bayesian or frequentist statistics, how we combine the data did not impact the result significantly. And we ended up with this value of 72 in the statistical and systematic errors shown there. As I mentioned, we also used the Spitzer infrared telescope. These are measurements of the Cepheid Leavitt law at 3.6 microns. These are observations subsequent to Hubble. The points on the right here are from our nearby neighbor, the Large Magellanic Cloud. You can see the dispersion is small. I mentioned 0.1 magnitudes corresponds to 5% in distance for a single star. And these are the parallax measurements measured using the Hubble Space Telescope. I'll say more about recent parallax measurements in a moment. And we measured a distance to this nearby neighbor. The Large Magellanic Cloud comes out at about 50 megaparsecs using the Cepheids calibrated with the geometrical parallaxes for Cepheids in the Milky Way. And we obtained a value of the Hubble constant of 74. It's a recalibration of the key project sample. That we can compare now with a geometric technique. This is using detached eclipsing binaries. And this group has been measuring a distance to the LMC, which is now at a level of 1%. And you can see it agrees extremely well with what we get independently for the Cepheids. Now, Adam Rees and his group have been extending the supernova distance scale, discovering Cepheids in galaxies that have been host to type 1a supernovae. It's a large program. They've had over 1,000 orbits of Hubble, and they have the distances now to 19 galaxies measured using Cepheid variables and type 1a supernovae. So the scatter goes up with distance. Here are the calibrators below, the Large Magellanic Cloud, the Milky Way, and our nearby Andromeda galaxy. And then this is the Maser galaxy that I mentioned, NGC 4258. And the scatter already goes up. This is a galaxy at a distance of 7.6 megaparsecs. That's nearby. The most distant ones in this sample go out to about 30 megaparsecs. So measuring the luminosities accurately becomes more of a challenge as you go to a larger distance, where the resolution set by your detector becomes worse as you go to larger distances. And so the issues that concern me still, having spent a lot of time working on Cepheids, are: have we constrained metallicity effects at the point where we can make a 1% measurement of the Hubble constant, as now some people are claiming? We also have to worry about stellar evolutionary effects. We know that Cepheids cross their instability strip several times during their evolution. That's not an issue when you're trying to resolve a factor of two, or even likely at the 5% level, but it could be an issue at the 1% level. So it's something we do need to look into more closely. And because of the rarity of supernovae, as I mentioned, our samples are still small. But the issue that may be one of the systematics that needs to be ascertained is not impacting the luminosities of these Cepheids is, as you go to these more distant galaxies, are the images of the Cepheids themselves being blended, or are the stars being crowded? And as I already showed you, even at 7.6 megaparsecs in a calibrating galaxy, the scatter jumps to almost 4/10 of a magnitude, or 20% in distance. So and I should add that people have been trying very hard to do artificial star experiments to ascertain whether or not this is a problem. And that's been done out to about 20 megaparsecs, but the more distant samples now are pushing farther out to 50 and even 100 megaparsecs. So it is something we need to just keep an eye on. And this is an example of one of the Cepheids in NGC 4258. You can see in the optical here on the left, the star is relatively isolated, but in the infrared, again, where the effects of dust and metallicity are smaller, you have to contend with the fact that you have companion red giants, or even brighter so-called asymptotic giant branch stars in your field of view that may be possibly contributing a systematic effect, particularly when you're trying to correct for the presence of dust and metallicity, that it's covariant. And this is, I should just mention, one of the brightest Cepheids in the sample in the second nearest galaxy in the sample. So it only gets harder as you go to lower luminosity and greater distances. Now, let me say a few words about the tip of the red giant branch method. It's not as well known as the Cepheids, but these stars have been studied now for decades. And from a theoretical perspective, their evolution is actually much better understood. These are low mass stars, solar mass or so less. Once they've exhausted the hydrogen in their cores, The temperature is not high enough to ignite helium, burn heliums in a stably, the triple alpha process. The star then it continues to contract, and it ultimately is supported by degeneracy pressure. Around the core, the degenerate electro helium core, there is a hydrogen burning shell. That's what powers the luminosity. The star can't expand the way a normal star would as the temperature increases, because it's degenerate. And so the temperature continues to increase until it reaches about 100 million degrees. Then triple alpha process can start, known as the core helium flash, because there's a thermal runaway at this point. And the star settles down, then lowers in luminosity onto the so-called horizontal branch. And that occurs at a really well-defined core mass because of the degeneracy. And so what that means is that it also occurs at a predictable luminosity. So it's much simpler in that sense than the Cepheid variables. We have to understand the pulsations and there are just a lot more parameters involved. And what that means in practice is that we can go to the halos of galaxies where we can find in some cases hundreds, and perhaps even up to some halos where we found tens of thousands of these stars, and they're occurring at this predictable luminosities I'll show you in a moment. So we've had a program for a number of years now, the Chicago Carnegie program, where we're using Hubble, the Magellan telescopes in Chile, Spitzer, as I mentioned, the Gaia satellite. Here's a robotic telescope we have on the mountain. And ultimately, we'll be using the James Webb Space Telescope, which is an infrared satellite that is the successor to Hubble. And it's already submitted proposals to use it. It's scheduled to be launched in October of this year. So here is where the Cepheids fields, where the Cepheids were discovered in NGC 4258, the same Maser galaxy. So again, Cepheids are young. We find them in the disk. This is a negative image here. Stars are dark, and the dust lanes you can see here are in white. And in the inner parts of the galaxy, the surface density is quite high, surface brightness is quite high. And so measuring accurate luminosities is a challenge, even in those somewhat nearby galaxies. And so this is why we became really interested in Tip of the Red Giant Branch, because we could go out to the halo and avoid the disk altogether and all the complications of the astrophysical dust and high surface brightness. Looks like there are no stars here with this contrast with the disk, but if we use the advanced camera for surveys on Hubble, in this particular field here, and I'll show you in a moment, there's archival data. We literally now have tens of thousands of stars in the region just below the Red Giant Branch. So here is the Red Giant Branch. This is luminosity again increasing up, and this is the color of the star, or effective temperature, decreasing to the right. And the Red Giant Branch stars are you can see here, and the stars above the Red Giant Branch are higher mass stars. These are AGB stars. They do occur in the halos of galaxies also, but the contrast still, they provide a pedestal to the background, pedestal to the Red Giant Branch stars, but we still are able to effectively measure the first derivative of the luminosity function for these stars. So marginalizing over this color magnitude diagram, we can run an edge detector that shows a response at the position of the core helium flash. Now in practice, we do all sorts of artificial star tests. We put in stars into our actual images, stars with the luminosity function of the Red Giant Branch, of the asymptotic giant branch, and retrieve those to understand what the systematic and statistical uncertainties are in measuring the position of this core helium flash. And we have two different parts of our team do this separately. So in that sense, it's a blind experiment, including the calibration, and only compare when they've done the measurements. So these are our halo fields using Hubble again. So just getting out of the disks of the galaxies. And in the end, we end up with 18 calibrators of type 1A supernovae. So This now is an example. This is Messier 66, a galaxy at 11 megaparsecs. That's farther than this NGC 4258. We measure out in the halo again, and these are just examples of stars in the halo where you can see that they are quite isolated. We don't have this issue with dust or with crowding of images. And I won't belabor this, but you know, here on the left are the color magnitude diagrams, the luminosity functions, and on the right, the edge detector responses for each of these galaxies, and you can see that they're quite well measured in all cases. We can then compare the distances measured using Tip of the Red Giant Branch and Cepheids. And what I'm showing here, so in, as I said earlier, there are no other methods where we can do this direct calibration from a geometrical to measurement of these nearby galaxies with a large sample. And the gray measurements are published values from the literature. And the red measurements here are objects that have Cepheid distances, Tip of the Red Giant Branch, and type 1a supernovae. So this is the overlap sample. And you can see, not unexpectedly, at the larger distances, the scatter goes up. Harder to make these measurements. And this is just blowing up those red points at the right. But what you can see is that the quoted uncertainties now, the estimated uncertainties in some cases are smaller than the scatter. Chi-squared is quite large. So there's something leading to increased scatter that we don't yet understand. One hint may be coming if we look at the measured scatter in the type 1a supernova magnitudes. So if we calibrate using Tip of the Red Giant Branch, what the supernova magnitudes are, we get a dispersion of about a tenth of a magnitude. That's consistent with what we see in the more distant Hubble diagram for the type 1a supernovae, but it is larger for the Cepheids. So calibrating using the Cepheids, the dispersion is larger than it is for the Tip of the Red Giant Branch. So maybe indicating that there's an issue there for some of the reasons that I have been describing. So I'll just quickly say a few words about the supernovae. This is a project that we carried out at Las Campanas. The idea was to observe these supernovae, follow up supernovae that had been discovered in other surveys, but get 10 filter photometry to allow us to determine the reddenings very accurately and look for environmental effects, effects of metallicity, the mass dependence, and so on. And also really well observed spectra as a function of phase so that we could measure the so-called K corrections very accurately. So it's the most extensive self-consistent data set for dealing with systematics for the type 1a supernovae. And here's our Hubble diagram. This is the calibration using the Tip of the Red Giant Branch in red, our measurements of the distances. And here are the more distant supernovae. So this again is the distance modulus shown here. And this is just log of the redshift allowing for these cosmological terms, Q naught and J naught, which I should say are very small, extremely small, and only affect the outer points. The results do not change whether or not you include these in the cosmological model. But what we do is fit the light curve parameters, the light curves that I showed you in the previous slide. We use those parameters as inputs to a Markov chain Monte Carlo analysis, and then determine the Hubble constant, and we get a full covariance matrix. And as I said, we get this value just under 70. That's the value I showed you early on, where it comes from. Now, in the last year, because of this tension, I think it's really important that we continue to test these methods. One of the nice things about the red giants is that they do occur in spirals and ellipticals, in old populations, young populations. And we can look back at our own Milky Way galaxy. We know that there are these globular cluster systems. By the way, I think I saw Bill Harris's name early. If this is the Bill Harris of globular clusters, we've used your distance scale for comparison with our own. And this is a sample that has proper motions now measured by the Gaia satellite. So we can determine membership of these clusters very well. We've used a set of photometry that is a uniform set of photometry for these 46 clusters. These clusters in the Milky Way have a range of metallicities, abundances that are comparable to what we're seeing in the halos of galaxies. And we've used the horizontal branch that I mentioned, where the stars go after they hit the Corhelion flash luminosity. And we can use those as a relative measure of the distance to the clusters, starting with the Harris distances. And that's completely independent of the tip. When we do that, when we measure the luminosity of the tip, then that agrees with our earlier measurement at the 1% level. This was what we published last year. We can then go on to do the test in this NGC 4258, the Maser galaxy. And we've used archival data from the Hubble Space Telescope here in the halo of the galaxy. We're avoiding the disk. The other group has made measurements in here where we see disk dust and dust lanes and neutral hydrogen and so on. For all the reasons I've described, you want to be out in the halo, crowding, et cetera. And again, those measurements are coming in, so measurement again, and we've looked spatially within the halo, the very large sample of stars to do this. And when we compare the measurements of our earlier calibration with the measurement of the luminosity of these stars, again, the agreement is coming in at the better than 1% level, and it's complete. All of these are completely independent measurements. We've continued to test this with other nearby objects. I'm not going to say much about that, except again, the calibration is coming in quite consistently. So in terms of calibration, we're becoming more confident that the tip of the Red Giant branch is very reliable at this point at the better than 2% level. That's a conservative estimate. Now, I had mentioned to Latham when he first asked me to give this talk that we were really excited about the release from Gaia, this European satellite measuring parallaxes and proper motions now for a billion and a half stars. And our hope is ultimately this will provide a measurement of the zero point of both the Cepheids and the tip of the Red Giant branch that's better than 1%. That turns out to be, it's more difficult than I think Gaia had anticipated before. With the data release I guess 3 years ago, the parallax offset relative to a background sample of quasars, 500,000 quasars, was 29 micro arc seconds. That's now been improved, but it's still 17 micro arc seconds. The difficulty for us is that actually varies as a function of position. It's a function of the magnitude of the star, the color of the star, and the position of the star. And it's happening at the tens of micro arc second level. And this is from one of the Gaia papers that shows these fluctuations on degree level scales across the sky. This is smoothing the parallaxes for the Large Magellanic Cloud so they can measure these RMS variations. And for us, that makes it very problematic. We've been looking at the globular clusters. Again, here's a comparison now with the Harris distance scale for a sample of clusters that we were looking at that had the proper motions before. And you can see that these fluctuations here, the 30 and in some cases higher fluctuations are contributing. This is 30% distance indicator, distance error for some of the more distant. This is predicted parallax from the Harris sample, and we've also looked at other samples. So the relative distances are well determined, but Gaia at the moment is suffering from these fluctuations across the sky. So we're not using the EDR3 data for our calibration. The other methods that we have right now are at much higher level of accuracy. So I'm just going to show you a summary plot of recent values of the Hubble constant. You may have seen these charts that get shown where you see the CMB values on one side and then a listing of all the methods that give all these high values of the Hubble constant. But I think you also have to pay attention to the uncertainties. These are just the quoted published uncertainties for each of these methods shown here. So the Maser distances that There simply just aren't very many of these objects. There's surface brightness fluctuations, Mira variables. There's only one Mira galaxy, one supernova distance. I mentioned the gravitational wave sirens. So my sense of this is that in the next few years, many of these methods will have many more objects. There'll be many more opportunities to compare them. But at the moment, at the tip of the Red Giant Branch, and I'm only, by the way, showing you our uncertainties that we published, the new data that I've shown you today, the tests of the zero point based on NGC 4258 and the globular clusters in the Milky Way have not been folded into this. So most of the weight for the higher value of the Hubble constant is coming from the Cepheids, including our own work and that of Adam Riess. And as I showed you, there's a difference in the two. And of course, in this case, there's only one distance to the galaxies that were each of the galaxies we're measuring. So this is a systematic issue that we need to resolve and we can resolve. And so I think the next few years are going to be really interesting for trying to understand where this tension is arising. We will eventually get Gaia parallaxes to better than a percent. We're working on improving the calibrations to the nearby galaxies using Hubble. And the James Webb Space Telescope, which is an infrared telescope, the Red Giant Branch stars are bright in the infrared. We can observe them out to much larger distances and increase the numbers of calibrators that we have for the type 1A supernovae. And we're working very hard to look at the galaxies where we've noted these discrepancies. So I'm going to end by saying that Hubble tension, in my view, remains unresolved. I think there is very much the exciting possibility that there is new physics beyond standard model, and that is supported by the data for Cepheids from our own work with Spitzer and from the Key Project and the SHOES Riess et al. Team. There's some evidence, some supporting evidence from less accurate methods, but those also will improve with time. I think there are indications that there may be systematic errors in the local distance scale. Interestingly, the tip of the Red Giant Branch results do not require new physics. So I do think for the reasons that I've said that we do need to understand the systematics in both the tip of the Red Giant Branch and Cepheids. But the Cepheids, are having worked on Cepheids for a long time, I can tell you they are more complicated. And so I think this will take a little longer to sort out. And so I remain very optimistic. We will be able to solve this issue. It's very clear cut what the next steps are and the facilities that are coming online in the next few years. And then longer term with other completely independent techniques, we will be able to get to the bottom of source of this tension, determine whether it is new physics or something perhaps related to astrophysics. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Wendy, for that talk. So may I start by asking if there are any questions from students?
Are you going to leave or are you going to?
Sheila knows I'm going to be a bit late.
Well, I want to phrase the question in my own way. That's
Bill, I think you may be unmuted. Are you?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Do you want to ask something?
Sorry. Am I interrupting a student here?
Well, that's a good question. Are there? We usually start with student questions first. Are there any student questions? If not, why don't you go ahead, Bill?
Okay. Thanks very much. I'm just Wendy. I'm very much in favor of the TRGB work, as you might guess. It's very interesting to see the H naught values that are coming out of it at this point. The James Webb telescope seems like it would be a great instrument to extend further, as you've said. I just wonder what your quantitative impression is as to how much further out one can get. I mean, the more remote the galaxy target, then the more crowding will become an issue until finally it'll turn into just surface brightness fluctuations. But I mean, quantitatively, how far do you expect to be able to push the TRGB technique?
Yeah, one of the nice things about the tip of the Red Giant Branch is that the so the giants are fainter in the optical, and then they get brighter in the infrared. So with the fact that James Webb is more sensitive in the infrared, and the tip of the red giant branch gets brighter, we're estimating somewhere between a factor of 3 and 4 in distance. And we've spent a lot of time with ground-based data and with HST trying to improve the calibration in the infrared to be ready for when James Webb will allow us to do that. And the nice thing, again, is that we can target both ellipticals and spiral galaxies. And so there still is this issue that for the type 1a supernovae, there appears to be a mass luminosity relation, luminosity of the peak luminosity of the supernova with the mass of the galaxy. And so ellipticals being more massive, you really want to be comparing apples with apples. So I like the fact that we will be able to extend to a larger volume and also calibrate both supernovae in both kinds of galaxies. About a factor of 4 is we're hoping we can go. And I don't want to push this, I have to say. So we've got proposals now that we're preparing for Hubble, and I want to stay closer than 20 megaparsecs. And I think where we're really going to learn about the issues that are plaguing us, these systematic types of things, is to get really high signal to noise, uncrowded data.
So, but adding to that, Wendy, it's Gretchen now. How many galaxies do you think you're going to be able to add into that less than 20 megaparsecs regime to really figure out the scatter and the line that you're going to find?
Very small for less than, I think we can get another half a dozen or so in that range, and we're working on trying to do that now. But then we will be able to double our sample with James Webb within a few years. Just in the surveys that are going on now, like ZTF, we're collaborating with people there, and we can go out, maybe push to 40. I'm going to try and stick to as close to 30 as we can, but it appears that on that time scale, we should be able to double the sample.
Well, as you point out, that it's a relatively simple method to apply and to understand, and that makes it very attractive.
Yeah, so from my view, it makes it very attractive. And the Cepheids may be right, but we got to check them.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you.
Nice to see you both, by the way. It's been years.
You too.
Yeah.
I see Emil put a question in the chat. He says, can you explain a little more detail what the issue with the scatter and the Gaia parallax data is? Is this just a matter of increasing statistics, or is there a systematic issue not yet accounted for?
Yeah, there's a systematic issue not yet accounted for. And there are two arms of the interferometer that, as they're scanning through the sky, the telescope has, there's an effective temperature. And, as it's heating and cooling, of course, very small, but they're trying to measure very small parallaxes. And so it's something that they have to get a much longer baseline to take out those effects at a systematic level. So they can compare relative to this 500,000 sample of quasars, for which they're, very good radio interferometric parallaxes for. And as I showed you, when they compare with the Large Magellanic Cloud, so it's, the parallax Magellanic Cloud is very small, but you can measure RMS fluctuations by smoothing the measurements over the galaxy. And these things are at the level of 10, 20, 30, 50 micro arc seconds. So that has the effect of it increases the scatter and the period luminosity relation. So the sample that we have from Hubble, the uncertainties are much smaller than the current Gaia ones. And as I showed you the comparison with the Harris data, those relative measurements of globular clusters now have been really well constrained by the work of Bill and his collaborators and others over the years. And when you look at the fractional parallax errors, as I showed you, they're very large. And so we had posted a paper on the archive a few months ago based on the proper motion Gaia DR2 data that I showed you, that we would just replace it with EDR3. And that's what I was talking to Latham about early on. I thought I'd have results to present to you, but it just in practice has not turned out to be possible yet. We'll have to be patient.
Oh, sorry. Are there any other questions?
I have a question.
Yes, John.
Well, from a theoretical point of view, if the TRGB results are correct, then as you point out, you don't need require new physics. So from a theoretical point of view, we may be just speculating until you resolve this issue. On the other hand, if there is a discrepancy, then one of the important assumptions in Larmor CDM is that it satisfies the Freeman-Lemaître-Robertson-Walker space-time. And densities and Hubble constant are just time-dependent. There's no spatial dependence. So there was a lot of work done some years ago on a different solution of Einstein's field equations. It's called the Tolman-Bondi, Lemaître-Bondi solution. It's an inhomogeneous solution. And so you have spatial dependence as well as time dependence. And there are very large voids that we've observed. So we could be sitting in one of these voids, and et cetera. It's a toy model because it's spherically symmetric. However, it indicates that if something like that is happening, so there are two dependencies of the Hubble constant, spatial as well as line of sight radial. And it turns out that getting a different value of H naught from the CMB compared to local values is becomes rather an obvious prediction. However, all of this has to be checked by the CMB data, and so that you get a results for CMB and so on as accurate as we have now from the Planck data results. But I just wanted to say that we have to maybe look further in the assumptions of the basic model Larmor CDM. The many proposals for solving the problem are pretty well all based on the FRW space-time. And that's a big assumption.
Yeah, I think it's something, I agree with you. There could be, and I think one of the things you're getting at is that we might be living in a local volume that's under dense, say, compared to the overall distribution of matter. And I think constraints of that have gotten better. I agree with you that we should continue to probe that and to understand at what level you could see fluctuations of that kind. Supernova data have gotten much better simply because the scatter in the supernova Hubble diagram is so small. When we were arguing between 50 and 100 or 50 and 80, at that time, I think one of the arguments was that we did live in a local underdense region, and you could explain the difference between 50 and 80 that way. But the scatter in the supernova diagram, again, is at a few percent level now. And so large inhomogeneities are at least out to the distances might have a plot from Adam Rees. Measuring, you know, could there be a difference between the local and the global measurement of H naught? And so going out to redshifts now of 0.4 or so and binning the data, trying to determine what the dispersion is, the difference between a local and a global measurement is less than a percent or so. And so the constraints are getting tighter. And I take your point. And also the fluctuations in the and the CMB, those also, the scales of those are you know, put constraints on how big the fluctuations could be. I think it's likely still to be an issue. People want to be measuring the Hubble constant now to 1%. You probably can tell from the comments that I've made, I don't think we're near 1% at that time. And when we get to the 1% level, this is the kind of issue that I think we will need to understand better, because it's very likely to be entering at that level. But in terms of explaining a discrepancy between 67 and 74 at the moment, that appears to be ruled out if this is the reason that's being suggested, it's not compatible with the data.
Thank you.
We have time for maybe one last question. Anybody? Maybe, Wendy, could I ask one thing? In our cosmology group meeting maybe about a year ago, I wish I remembered the name of the authors, but somebody presented a paper from roughly a year ago showing that for this subsample of supernovae where you can see a supernova and a Cepheid in the same galaxy, this calibrating sample, that a paper was claiming, you know, it basically plotted the metallicity of the galaxy versus the luminosity of the supernova and claimed that, you know, there was some evidence for some correlation between the two that would, I think they were arguing in that paper that it went in the direction of reducing the inferred amount of dark energy, but it also seemed to go in the direction to, you know, reduce the measured value of the Hubble constant. And I remember leaving that group meeting with the thought that was probably looked like the most plausible explanation for why this Cepheid supernova measurement might be systematically too high of H naught. Does that sound like one of the leading contenders to you, or no?
I think it is an open possibility, and I think so. So in terms of, I'm wondering whether this was the metallicity of the supernovae or metallicity of the Cepheids. Which one are you?
I think it was the metallicity of the host galaxy that they were correlating with the. I think the way it went was that if you imagine that galaxies were systematically got lower and lower metallicity at higher distance scale, it would correlate with supernovae being, you know, intrinsically dimmer than you thought, and so the inferred Hubble constant would be lower.
Been a number of studies of that type, and particularly there's a group in Europe that's been looking into that. What we all see when we look at the supernovae is that there's correlation, this correlation I alluded to, between the mass of the galaxy and the supernova luminosity. And of course, physically that makes no sense, right? There's obviously some local environmental effect that's perturbing the luminosity of the supernova, not the overall mass of the galaxy, and metallicity is a contender for that. You know, the star formation rate could be different, the pollution then in the regions where the supernovae are formed changing as a function of environment and time and so on. And so people do correct for this mass luminosity effect. And then of course there's the issue if your calibrators are spiral galaxies like the Cepheids, but your host galaxies are ellipticals, that you may be suffering a systematic effect. Now people have tried, you know, you can exclude the ellipticals, look only at the spirals, and it's not going to explain the whole effect, but this could be a series of systematics. You know, the probability they all go in the same direction is unlikely, but these things happen. So I think it's something still in play and something that we need to understand better. And as the data improve, we will.
Okay. Well, I think there have been a lot of questions. In view of time, why don't we thank Wendy one more time for a great talk.